Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Untangled Resolution's presentation of Sangoma, Tales from the Frontlines of Mediation. I am your host, Batavi Livingtumbany, mediator and conflict coach, and my guest today is Deborah Oliver, and I'm so truly excited to share some time talking with her about her journey into and through mediation. I'd like to welcome Deborah to the show now. And Deborah, your mic is live. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. And I have to say, reading from the information that you sent me, we're in for quite a ride here.
An enjoyable ride.
Well, let's start at the beginning. You described your childhood. You said, you know, you were born, was it sort of 50 feet from Warner Brothers Studios, right.
Beautiful downtown Burbank. Yeah, right?
Right,
St. Joe's Hospital just across the street from Warner Brothers, yeah.
And
so I'm a Hollywood girl, graduated from Hollywood High, in the Hollywood Bowl, you know, things like that. So it was exciting.
When you describe your family and your parents and so forth, what came to my mind was, you know, Lucy and Ricky Ricardo. And it, you know, this kind of thing that one reads about in novels or sees in the movies. What was your childhood like?
Well, you know, it was strange, okay? I grew up in the 50s, and, yes, in a show business family. My father was a big band leader, so that genre of music was very big, you know, in the World War II era. And I was a late child. He was nearly 50 when I came on scene. So, you know, that whole era of music went... had a rocky ride with the introduction of rock and roll and whatnot. So it was lots of ups and downs and so forth. So I also got to see sort of the dark side of Hollywood, you know, as well as the bright and glistening side with all the bling and whatnot. So, you know, it was quite an education. And I find just anecdotally, I've never done an evidence-based study on it, but people in, I work with a lot of lawyers, even though I'm not one, and what I notice is that they either come from or retire into the arts at a huge rate. And so coming from a sort of theatrical background myself, I found that I could connect with their, you know, sort of theatrical bent, and find a way in, you know, because they're actually quite into performance if they're trial lawyers anyway. And in fact, when I was in theater, I created a form of training for actors that was quite unusual. And among the other students who would come besides actors, oddly, were clergy and trial lawyers.
Right.
So,
yes.
I've
actually heard it joked, you know, a joke that says that, you know, lawyers and trial lawyers particularly are just frustrated actors.
I did this huge case at one point where there were 30 people at the table. A whole subdivision was suing each other, and there were 12 countersuits and 11 attorneys, and then a whole group who were pro se. But, you know, on the break, you could hear the lawyers talking in the hallway going, "Darn, I thought I had the Emmy until you did that. No, you have the Emmy." And it's like, guys, I read you. I get it. You know, I know what's happening here. So it's fun.
Well, we definitely want to talk about that case. That is actually one of the things that I wanted to talk about. But, yes, you make quite the observation about the link between you know, lawyers and acting and mediators in acting, too. I think, you know, a lot of what we have to do,
you know,
is
in my
performance
early
of the kind.
Acting training, you know, everything, I mean, serious actors are really all about human motivation, and they're quite the student of it. In fact, I remember as a teen, I would go to the Hollywood Farmers Market. I had assignments to do people watching. And I would sit there for a whole afternoon watching families and people and try to see how quickly I could drill into their reality. You know, what was their dynamic? What were their conflicts? Who was the odd one out? What was the family system? And they probably thought it was a little strange for this crazy blonde lady to be sitting there watching them. But, you know, it was my homework, right? So I've always had an interest in what motivates people and what causes conflict and how is it resolved. And I think it's just a part of the DNA.
I was going to ask you if you understood why you were so fascinated by that. But then again, if it is one of those things where perhaps one can't point to a particular incident or, you know,
no,
a root cause
really.
for the fascination with it. But
yes,
that is something I think that mediators carry as a common characteristic, is a fascination with human behavior and human relationships. I also note that you have a really independent streak, and it seems that it asserted itself early on. You were doing some acting as a child.
Yeah. You're talking about when I got kicked off the television show? Is that the one
you're
talking about? Yeah. Well, I had a starlet Sunday school teacher who somehow convinced NBC to have a live Sunday morning show called Faith of Our Children. And it was a classroom. It was very structured, and a classroom and Q&A and that sort of thing. And I had not one but two older brothers and two older male cousins. I was the youngest. And I was subject to not a little bit of bullying. And so very early on, I sort of got that, you know, I'm kind of not okay with this. And anyway, so we were live on TV, and the teacher asked, okay, class, if Johnny bullies you on the playground at school, will you A, turn the other cheek like Jesus said, B, tell a teacher, or C, strike back? And my hand shot up, and... Debbie! And I just got up there, and I had just been one of those days where I just had it, you know, and I went off like a volcano, saying I would push him to the ground and grind his face into the asphalt and make him scream, and I used, you know, heavily laced with street language because I grew up in Hollywood. And so I looked over, and the director's always behind these big, you know, cameras, and he was raking his index finger over his throat, and I thought, oh, I bet that means cut to a commercial. And sure enough, it did, and I was off, and there was an empty seat there until he could replace me. So,
oh, mercy.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, yes, still, though, in terms of standing your ground and speaking out and so forth, I wonder whether that's something that carries through into your practice.
Well, I'm quite a bit more reserved now, being 63. I've had a lot of time to work with, you know, those issues and so forth. So, I'm quite a bit quieter now. You know, it's really a lot about listening and saying as little as possible, but when you do, to try to have it be like a trim tab on an airplane, you know, that might, you know, redirect some of the currents that are going on, and mainly not making statements but asking questions more, right?
Well, yes,
I mean,
and I think what I'm really, and I think what I'm really getting at, though, is more about a certain kind of firmness or constitution of character that mediators must have, especially when mediating, you know, highly contentious situations, many people involved, entrenched and so forth. And while mm-hmm. it is true that the meat eater wants to get out of the way, at the same time, there may be moments where one must assert herself for himself.
Oh, absolutely. And that's absolutely true. It's more of a demeanor, I think, than anything else. Mm-hmm. And it's not hard for me that much to achieve because I'm nearly 6 feet tall, and I have something of a slightly imposing presence, I guess. So I don't have to assert it. I like to, when I train mediators or talk to other mediators, there's a metaphor that I use that the power that we exert, if you will, is what I call holding the bowl.
Yeah.
In other words, that the whole environment and everybody in it is inside, the conflict itself is inside a bowl, an invisible bowl that you're holding. And so you're not, down on the ground, rolling around in the mud pit with them. It's holding the space, holding this invisible bowl that allows them to relax into the reality of what they're dealing with. And it gives a sense of assurance that somebody's holding them, you know,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
not holding them down, just holding them. It's so, to me, critical that, you know, the very first step is creating a safe space.
Yeah.
And I'm so aware that sometimes it's the first time they've ever been in a safe space. Sometimes this is their first time, especially working with young people, with youth. They haven't been in a safe space. School isn't safe. A lot of times home isn't safe. Certainly the streets are not safe. And to be in a place of safety and dignity where their voice counts, it's sometimes first time. And I think that's so very important because the rest of it kind of takes care of itself in a way. I mean, you do guide and ask questions and write up agreements and things, but it's that unseen spiritual force, if you will, you know, that I think is so miraculous in mediation.
Oh, certainly, certainly. And then it is part of the character of a mediator to be able to provide that kind of support and to create that space. And in terms of the things that have informed your character, then there is more. So you have this early acting experience, which wasn't exactly acting. You were being yourself on this uh-huh. show. But it turns out that you then chose to further your education in acting.
Yes, I did. I was very serious about it for quite some time. I went to Juilliard School for the Performing Arts, Drama Division, and was really pursuing that. But at least when I was there, it felt a little bit like attending school was like attending a madhouse. You know, it was really crazy. I admit that I left before graduation, just because I didn't want to, I didn't think, I had issues with how they trained actors.
Okay.
I had issues with, you know, the fact that it was very abusive, you know, just abuse yourself to whatever extent to get the reaction, you know. And that's why I went off and created my own sort of school of actor training, because I wanted it to be a healing process, not a self-destructive process. In other words, they would teach you to get into character, but never how to get out. So pretty soon the boundary lines fizzed out into this place where, you know, you were just this stage that all these spooks and, you know, ghosts were traversing, and it drove people crazy. I mean, and that I found that to be very disturbing. You know, there were five nervous breakdowns in my class of 35. That's a lot.
Yeah.
You know, that's a lot. And so I truly didn't want to, you know, go insane.
Yes,
so
right.
And studied Eastern philosophy and married and traveled and did radio and had a theater company and did other things. You know, so I didn't get into mediation until later in my life when I was 39. So it was just like a homecoming. It was like I'd been wandering, you know, in the desert or something. And then I found, you know, my home. So I was very grateful.
Well, it seems that the experiences that you've had were really wonderful in terms of preparing you for what you are doing now. You know, the acting and the sense of presence that one must have in order to do that, and then recognizing when you were at Juilliard that there are safer ways of expressing and then, you know, creating an environment in which you invited actors to do that. And then also going to study Eastern philosophies. And I found that quite telling as well. It seemed to me, and, I may be projecting here, but it seemed to me a quite understandable reaction to having experienced what you did for the 2 years that you were at Juilliard to turn into a study of a philosophy that's all about cleansing.
Right, absolutely. Well, you know, I was very much into the ethos of the ancient Greek theater, which it was intended to be a healing process. Actors were required to be initiates of the Eleusinian mysteries, and the population was required to attend prior to planting. A week of tragedies and then a week of comedies, and then they would go do their Bacchanalian rites and plant their fields. You know, that was the culture. So I was very much kind of attuned to that. Its purpose was a healing purpose. You know, our storytelling is a healing purpose. Our, you know, mediation is, there's a lot about the narrative, the story. And that's all a part of our DNA, I think. We have to, as your company, untangle, you know, the story. And it's an adventure, right? So,
right. Quite an adventure.
Yeah.
And I would love to talk a bit about the adventures that you've experienced in your practices in mediation, but I do want to share what you wrote about mediation in your message to me, and I found it tremendously profound. You wrote that mediation is both an art and a discipline that lifts people out of their often desperate entrapment in conflict. This art, you write, requires the courage to remain unshaken and supportive while people disgorge their suffering, anger, and darkness. A good mediator simply must love human beings and understand what makes them tick.
Yes.
And what better,
you
know, a preparation that you've had than, what better preparation could you have had than that what you had in both in terms of acting and then in your studies and so forth. And so we come to your practice, and you say that you didn't discover mediation until you were 39.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Right. And then it was just like, it was just like an instantaneous miracle of finding myself, you know. It was.
Well,
just,
how did it happen?
Well, I was a single mother in Sedona, Arizona, and doing whatever one had to do to make a living. And raised my son, and I was in the library one day, and there's a big free rack, they called it. People would put books and magazines they no longer wanted and offer them for free. And as I was walking past the free rack, this magazine jumped off the shelf and landed at my feet. And I still have it. It was an issue of a magazine called The Legal Reformer, and it was all about mediation. And I read it voraciously and thought, well, hallelujah, this is it. That's what I am. I need to be a mediator. And within a week, I was in a training with the Arizona Attorney General's Civil Rights Unit. I have no idea to this day. I can't remember how I got into the training, how I heard about it. It was just the declaration, and bang, there I was,
was.
So it was just great. And I have, like I say, never looked back.
Well, in never looking back, you've ventured forth into quite the practice, over 900 mediations, over 800 resolutions, and the people...
Conciliations,
and the people whom you describe as being your clients, or the folks that you've served, run toward the colorful sometimes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've had a lot of colorful clients, I have to say. I've taken on a lot of big cases. They're all big because it's somebody's life, right?
Right.
But I've taken on some rather large multi-party, really heavily entrenched cases. I did a land grant dispute in Truchas, New Mexico, and if your listeners don't know what a New Mexico land grant is, it was partly how the King of Spain settled New Mexico, that he would give a certain group of people coming over from Spain or indigenous people, this tract of land that they had to agree to stay on and to develop, and they had to have a plaza, and they had to, you can't sell your parcels of a land grant. So these folks have been there together for 400 years. So when they have a blood grudge, it goes deep, okay?
Wow.
Really deep.
Wow.
So, it's very rare that somebody who is not a native New Mexican would even wind up doing such a case.
Well, how did you wind up doing that case?
I marched into First Judicial District Court here and spoke with the chief judge. And I've been banging my head against their doors for a long time, and they still really insist that if you're going to be a mediator for their court, you have to be a lawyer. And I'll be darned if I'm going to law school. I'm not. So that's just not going to happen. But anyway, I was speaking with this one judge and said, look, arbitration is really taking off. And, if it really goes as far as some people intend, we'll both be out of a job. So I really think you need to start looking at mediation. Why don't you send me 5 cases and see what I can do? So he dug through his files and dug out, the junkyard dog, ugly, horrible cases. Every one of them was just a monster.
So that's how it happened.
He sent me those 5 cases, and I had 100% settlement rate on those 5 cases. But one of them was the land grant, and there were some very, very tough guys. I mean, they were all men. And very tough. If you ever saw the movie Milagro Beanfield War that Robert Redford did, those are those guys. That's who was at the table. And so I thought, well, interesting. So I need a co-mediator. And it was a big group. It was about 18 people, including attorneys,
wow.
5 countersuits, and very rough. And there had been, some bodily assault, battery, and involved, various things. But, I had to choose a place that had security. So I did it in this gated community that had, you know, really huge restaurant facilities and things like that. And I thought, what am I going to do? So I chose a co-mediator who was a member of another land grant so that the, you know, sort of, you know, cultural, you know, capacity was there. And then I also had a full-time facilitator there so that if the small pockets had to go off and caucus, that the facilitator would remain with the rest of the group and keep the energy level up and, you know, summarize what had been done so far and, you know, keep the process going while we went off and caucused. But I also decided, and I wasn't sure at the time whether it was a wise decision, but I thought, I really want to evoke these men underneath all of their rough, you know, they're gentlemen. They are. Yes. They have a lot of pride. They have a deep culture, and that needs to be respected. And so I chose an all-female team so that we were at their service, you know, and we called them gentlemen and gentlemen this and gentlemen that, and they stepped up, and they were gentlemen. And it was amazing because we had alerted the banquet staff and everything that, you know, if we call security, we need them now, right? Mm-hmm. And so everybody was sort of on edge, and we had to give a separate restroom for this group and a separate place to eat for that, you know, and all that at lunch. And so they were all kind of on pins and needles, really curious, you know, what was going on in that room, because they saw them walk in and they were like, you know. And so, as the day wore on, they really had just this amazing transformation. And the conference room was very comfortable, but had a Kiva fireplace, you know. So at the end, of course, there's always, you know, the necessity to destroy the notes and just keep the agreement and everything. So I had preset that there, you know, there was the ability to have a fire. You know, it was all stacked up with wood and everything. So when we finished, we collected all the notes and then we set them on fire. And
so it has that really deep ceremonial feel to it.
It really did. And then they walked out with their arms around each other and they went to the restaurant and the bar, and the staff were like, what did you do in there? What happened? And we were like, well, it's confidential, sorry. But it was that's the trouble with us mediators, that everything is so confidential that
right. It's
hard, you know, kind of get traction in the public eye, right? Because we have to be quiet about everything.
It is, it's quite a dilemma. It is quite the dilemma for the profession. How do we market, you know, and when I say market, it's not just tell people what the services are, but help them to understand how they're going to feel.
Right.
Which is the crux of marketing.
You
know,
and
it's difficult
it's
to
one.
Find ways to be able to do that. Well, you... actually, let me back up for a moment and delve a little bit more into the cultural aspects of the mediation that you did. I think that's so very important. And also, you know, I think mediators are often presented with dilemmas about, you know, am I the right person? Are they going to relate to me? Or will
right.
they find me relatable? Will I miss something because I'm not familiar with the culture and so forth? And, you know, in choosing your team, I'm, first of all, impressed that you have the foresight to choose a team, you know, and have
mm-hmm.
have these specific roles for them that were so very helpful. But then in terms of the cultural aspect of things, did it turn out to actually matter?
It mattered enormously, especially in the land grant case. One of the things I did to sort of set the tone, other than to have a Hispanic land grant member co-mediator, was to get a great big blow-up like the size of a big flip chart, you know, of the mm-hmm. preamble to the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which is the treaty that originated the land grants. And so when they walked in, that is what greeted them. You know, one sign said welcome, and the other had the preamble of the Treaty of Guadalupe.
Hmm. So kind of remind them of the grounding.
Yeah. Not only that, but that I wasn't some, you know, ignorant woman who flew in from L.A. and never heard of it, right?
Sure. Did they test you at all?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they did. But oddly, one of the attorneys jumped in and, you know, because it was something like, what do you know? And he just jumped up and said, she knows a lot. A lot. And I was like, okay, let's move on. Well, they did. And that's okay because, you know, it's their... It's their culture. It's their issue. And, you know, if they're not comfortable, I mean, I had to be willing to leave it in the hands of my co-facilitators, you know, my co-mediator. And you know, if the comfort level wasn't there. But, you know, they did give me the benefit of the doubt at that point, you know, because, again, I don't care what culture you're from, if someone works with you respectfully, you know, if there is, you know, fundamental respect for who you are and what's important to you, it's hard to hang on to, you know, because it's so satisfying to be listened to, you know.
Oh yes, absolutely. Yeah, and then I think there's an opportunity to have an advantage sometimes in being an outsider. To allow an opportunity for folks to explain things and to hear each other's explanation of things,
mm-hmm.
and you know, and in the process of explaining it, have a better understanding or perhaps a more nuanced understanding of it themselves.
Mm-hmm. Although that, you know, that's what would be a homeopathic dose to my mind. In other words, it's not about me. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's not. About them,
right?
You know,
right.
That's it.
Right.
And
yeah.
if their culture and their mores and everything are front and center, then that's what needs to be front and center. That's just the way
right.
it is.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you've also done some interesting work in restorative justice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm curious about how you came to incorporate that into your practice and what's involved in that.
Well, I had always wanted to do it, and you know, just getting the opportunity and whatnot. But I learned that the state of New Mexico was coming down the pipeline with a request for proposals to have restorative justice be a part of the reform process of the juvenile justice system. And so I got a group together, got us trained, got
mm-hmm.
us ready, and then we went to the juvenile probation officers, you know, the children, youth, and families, before the RFP ever came out, and said, we know this is coming out, and you're going to be asked to cooperate with whoever the provider winds up being. We would like to do 10 cases for you pro bono so you have an understanding of what this process is. And so we did that, and that really served all of us really well because we were green at it and we had a learning curve, and so did the JPOs. And so, but by the time the RFP came down the pipeline, we're ready to apply, and we had a whole programmatic, everything was up and running, and the, you know, Santa Fe JPOs were fully familiar with what we were talking about. So we got the contract, and now we're in our sixth year of that, working with youth in the juvenile justice system. So it's very gratifying. We really know we're sawing a big dent in the school-to-prison pipeline, which is very gratifying.
I'm sure. So, absolutely.
You know, and I'm a mom, so I, you know, happen to really love children and their families. So it was kind of a no-brainer. It was just the opportunity finally showed up to actually realize that dream, and so it just showed up.
You know, I'm interested in delving into this a little bit more deeply because I'm thinking about some opportunities, tremendous opportunities, that we tend to miss as a society in being so punishment-focused rather than perhaps, what's the word I want to use? Yeah, I'm thinking about the kind of substantial impact a restorative justice process can have on a young person's life outlook that
it's
would do so much more to permanently change the way that they relate to their communities and their sense of responsibility and, you know, their sense of character and so forth. What do you see happening with the young people that you work with who are involved in restorative justice processes?
Well, you know, we have a saying in our team that teenagers are like shiny new Lamborghinis with no steering wheel or brakes. They've just got this shiny new body and all this eagerness and all this juices running, and in the, you know, the prefrontal cortex is barely, you know, slogging along at 5 miles an hour, and they're going 90. So, you know, it's pretty common that they're going to make some mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
Very few of the youth that we have dealt with are what I would consider sociopaths, just barely any, and those are the ones who have been thrown out with the garbage by, you know, parents who are addicted to heroin, and they are raising themselves on the streets, and, you know, a gang is a family, and so on. The gangs here in Santa Fe are not like the Bloods and the Crips, you know, in L.A. I mean, you know, they're more like social clubs. They're a place to belong. They're a place to have reinforcement of cultural identity, you know, a place to go because their parents are working 3 jobs. So it's a little bit different. So if you can just sort of tweak the, you know, belonging needs into a slightly more, you know, helpful arena, or just bring the whole gang with you, you know, that'd be good. So on the whole, children are not criminals. I'm sorry, but they have needs that are not being met.
Right.
And they're survivors. They're going to get them met one way or another, and I think our schools are dismal failures at this point. You know, No Child Left Behind, and all of that sort of factory farming of instead of actually educare, you know, lead them out into who they are. Who they are isn't even on the radar anymore. So when they walk into restorative justice and find out that they're powerful and that, yes, this particular incident showed that they were powerful, you know, in terms of doing damage, but it goes both ways, you know. They can also be powerful for what's really good and constructive and, by the way, uses their talents and abilities. It's just, you know, mind-blowing. So last year we had a 7% recidivism rate.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's huge.
It's big. I mean, you know.
And I'm sure the courts have taken notice.
You know, hopefully.
We
if
hope?
They would
oh, really?
Only, well, you know, they like to say they're readers, but they don't read our final report.
Mm-hmm.
So, wow. But, yeah, I mean, the first year we were at it, it was like 25%. I mean, we were still getting our sea legs and trying to wrap our minds around this whole process. But, it's gone down every year, and it was 7% last year.
I want to ask then a little bit more about gang culture in Santa Fe. As you were describing, you know, things seem to be different there than they would be in L.A. or perhaps even in New York, even though, you know, my understanding is that groups or gangs like the Crips and the Bloods originated with a purpose of creating belonging and you know, the power of numbers and community service. And you know, it is tremendously unfortunate to see how things have turned out with those organizations or those gangs. In terms of what happens in Santa Fe, though, where is it that trouble begins? I mean, if the groups are mainly for folks to, young people perhaps, who are not finding their needs met in other ways to gather together and provide that for each other, where is it that the trouble comes from?
Well, New Mexico itself is a fairly poor state. You know, we're down there with Mississippi, and, you know, I mean, there's a lot of high-rent areas here in Santa Fe. It's got a lot of glamorous, you know, and artist colonies and all kinds of, you know, the opera and whatnot. But a lot of poor people as well. I'd say 75% of our youth are on free and reduced lunch.
Wow.
So there's, you know, there's huge economic issues with the families here, and also there's tension here between the traditional Hispanic, you know, families who have been here since 400 years ago when the King of Spain settled, you know, so they're very identified with being European. And very proud of their heritage, and they do not get along and play well together with the Latino community, some of whom are undocumented. So there's tension there, and that tension is reflected in the schools, and with no child left behind, which I think is a greater problem in our world than most would have a sense of. The pressure to get the scores, do the tests and everything, is driving a lot of schools to actually eject kids who have bilingual needs, kids who, you know, came from Juarez, which is a war zone, and they have PTSD, and a lot of things like that. So there are multiple challenges that we're looking at, not the least of which are budgetary. And so the children fall through the cracks.
Well, then you have an opportunity to, and you've seized this opportunity to provide a service that can perhaps reach into those cracks and pull them back up. And so I'm curious about what happens then. Yeah, when, you know, a young person or a group of young people have committed some kind of a violation, and they've been caught, and they are now being brought to justice, which traditionally we understand to be about punitive measures and about punishment.
Yeah.
And so I can imagine that that's what they're expecting when they come in to meet with you and with your team. What happens? I'm curious about that moment
where
the spark happens and they realize they have a chance for something different.
The first thing we tell them is this is not about punishment. This is about that, you know, life is about making choices, and it's about being accountable for our choices. And so we're not here to facilitate you being punished, but the price of admission is that we need you to be willing to talk about, tell the story of what happened, what did you do? Who do you think you harmed? You know, what inspired you to do it? What's happened since then? What have you learned? You know, and that's just an intake, right? And so, you know, in the actual restorative justice process, they start out, you know, which is, can be pretty intimidating. You've got a room full of 10 to 20 adults, you know. Some of whom you've harmed, and others are parents, and others are community members. But you have to tell your story and, you know, be accountable for what you did. And then they have to hear from around the circle, you know, the people that they've harmed, what the impact was, what it meant to them, how it hurt them, how it hurt their families and neighbors. And truly, that process. And then they hear from their parents and the people from the community. It's hard to listen to. It takes courage. But what it does is stimulate empathy. I mean, think of it. Teenagers are, you know, an limbic brain, right? They're emotional creatures. And when they are confronted with that emotion of, you know, the grief that they've caused, the harm that they've, you know, what it cost other people. Well, first of all, it blows their mind that they could ever be that powerful. They didn't think about it when they broke that windshield with a baseball bat. They were just out for a joyride, whatever. But really? No kidding. Oh, my gosh. You know, they just, it blows their mind, and it stimulates empathy. And that's where they live. They live in their feelings, and so, you know, it changes their feelings. And, you know, because, you know, you can't tell them, well, think before you act next time, because that's not how their brain is wired. But they are feeling beings, very much so, and that feeling changes them, because they wind up having empathy for you know, the harm parties and their parents, and it's a beautiful process. It's absolutely a beautiful process.
Do you have any recollections of any specific incident that exemplifies what you were talking about?
Well, I'll just give you a simple little one. Some boys were on a sleepover, and they went out in the neighborhood at 2 in the morning after drinking, I don't know how many Red Bulls, you know, and just went into cars that were unlocked and took stuff. And then the next day they were emboldened, so they went out and did it again, and these two boys. And the second time, the homeowner looked out and saw them in the car and called the police. And they were caught. And then, of course, they were tied to the other event because it was in their neighborhood. I mean, you know, they don't think about, like, let's go to a different zip code. No, they're down the street doing this to their neighbors. So anyhow, this one young man, and he was an honors student. He was studying to be, he was in the culinary arts. He wanted to be a 5-star chef. And, so we also work on what are their strengths, what do they like to do, what are their talents and abilities, right? And so as he was talking about, you know, not only what he did, but when we said, you know, he's in the culinary arts track at the high school, the father, the harm party, there was a father, a 10-year-old girl, and a mother, and the 10-year-old girl, well, the whole family was terrorized because they didn't know if they were being targeted by a gang, and they didn't know if they were going to come back and do more because they were called, they'd be called the police. They were fearing retaliation. The little girl was having nightmares about the boogeyman getting her in the middle of the night. She couldn't sleep. They were all upset. It was, you know, the offense itself was pretty minor, but the effect isn't. And so he was horrified when he heard that story. But when he was talking about what he was into, the father's eyes lit up, and he said, "Can you bake a really good pecan pie?" And he said, "Of course I can. I haven't had a good pecan pie since I left Texas. I am dying for a..." And the little girl goes, "Oh, can you do a cherry pie?" And mom is like, "Can you do an apple pie?" So that became the agreement, that he would himself bake these three pies and bring them over with his father. His father came and Haagen-Dazs, you know, and they sat in the home of the harm party and ate pie and ice cream.
Oh, my goodness.
And, you know, that kid will never do that again. I mean, he
you know, Deborah, as you're telling me this, and I'm struck by this outcome that happens and how there's potential for that in just about everything. And
mm-hmm.
we miss it so much.
We miss it. We miss it. And you know what? You saw the little video we did on restorative justice, and it didn't have all of the interview, but the retired district court judge, you know, made a comment that we have on tape that he thinks, you know, the entire judicial system needs to just be scraped down to the foundations and replaced with restorative processes. And,
oh, yes.
You know, we are wasting so much human potential by having a punitive model in incarceration and what. And I was in L.A. as a teenager when Charlie Manson was doing his thing, and he's still in jail. And, you know, I'd like to see him in jail still because I don't think he's a good candidate for restorative justice. But he's the exception. He's not the rule. And the younger we get them, the less likely we are to have the really hardened, true sociopaths, you know. And there will always be some, and we will always need protection, you know, from that element. But truly, this thing about, you know, prisons being enterprise zones, you know, places on the stock market, please. These are human beings. These are people who, I'd like to say that we all, every one of us has a key. We're born with a key, and we have a key that will unlock at least one other person on this planet. And if you lock up the keys, you're not just taking them away. You're taking, you know, do the math. It's exponential.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, I'm grasping a bunch of things that come out of that story that is just so awesome. I mean, just amazing. They coalesced around pie.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
around
so
food.
Simple and so profound. I mean, it's tremendously profound because it is so simple. And, you know, to have that interaction where he comes and he brings food, which, you know, goes down to the most basic of human needs. And, you know, they're able to connect with each other at that level and then build from that. And that actually is a nice segue into something else that I wanted to ask you about, which is about teaching. So the young people and the families and so forth, both the victims and the perpetrators who go through this restorative justice program have a great opportunity for learning, but that isn't the only kind of learning opportunity that you present. You also do training as well?
Mm-hmm. Right. My team and I, we have a restorative justice training that's 40 hours, and that is not just how to do the process that we use is community group conferencing, which we think is really highly, you know, one of the most effective. We also do victim-offender mediation, but you know what? It doesn't bring in the families, it doesn't bring in the community, and therefore it doesn't extend as far as the harm has extended. And also the support isn't there, right? And so we really abandoned victim-offender mediation very quickly as we were doing this contract, but we do have a training to that not only teaches the model, which is kind of a hybrid of the Maori model in New Zealand. They do family group conferencing, but community group conferencing adds the third leg of the stool, that of the community. And we also have, you know, really, really comprehensive implementation. When we were trained, they didn't give us the implementation piece. So we actually have all the forms that you need, the reporting mechanisms, but, you know, so all you need is to get, you know, your juvenile probation office in your state on board with some funding, and we can, you know, take it right off the shelf. And we have. I mean, there are people we've trained who have, like, gone out the following Monday and walked right into doing a program. And I think that's very important. So we do have that training. It's very good. It's very moving.
Absolutely.
And, there's that. I have a lot of trainings. People can go to my website and see what I have. I'm bringing one to New York over the Thanksgiving week on the November 30th in New York City. It's a one-day training called The Many Faces of Maslow, A Deep Exploration into Needs-Based Negotiation. So it's not just for mediators. It's also for performance improvement professionals or HR people, counselors, or just generally interested people. And it's a one-day training that really looks at, that's what we negotiate. Bottom line is we negotiate what people's needs are.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that
which
means,
and it's interesting. You know, I teach negotiation at the college level,
mm-hmm.
and one of the more interesting challenges that I have, and I find it a fascinating challenge, but one of the more interesting challenges that I find is helping my students to understand that the negotiation isn't necessarily really about the material issues, but that it is about needs. The material issues ultimately do relate to needs, and then there are other needs as well, the emotional needs and so forth. And, as you're saying, you have a sort of a take on Maslow. Can you briefly tell us a little bit more about what that means?
He was one of the fathers of humanistic psychology who really kind of had a heyday in the 60s, and he developed something called the hierarchy of needs, and he, so everybody, is very familiar with the triangle that has, physical needs, safety needs, belonging needs, esteem needs, and self-actualization, and, people are familiar with it often, but they're like, yeah, so, but what they don't understand is that depending on where people are or where they feel threatened, right, they will fight very hard or cave in very easily if they feel a certain need that is important to them right at the moment is being, either fostered or threatened. He also referred to another hierarchy of needs, a different, psychological framework. I mean, because the one that we're familiar with, he called the deficiency hierarchy, where people feel deficient. They feel that what they need is outside their skin. They have to go out into the world and seek it, like heat-seeking missiles. And, because they feel really like vitamin deficiency or some craving. And they negotiate in a certain way, from a more fear-based slant on life. But he referenced that there's a growth hierarchy, and I was mad at him for dying before he put one on a grid. So I worked with it for a long time and put it together, extrapolating many of the things that he said in his writings. And that would be the growth hierarchy. And the ground of being for people who are working their way up the growth hierarchy is not that they feel deficient, but that they feel full. They are full of energy, full of ideas, full of, inspiration, and they need a venue to express that fullness. And so it's a completely different approach. That when you put the two of them together, say in a workplace, and you've got somebody who's on the deficiency hierarchy who's just kind of at the bottom there, doing whatever they can do to just make a paycheck, and they don't really care that much about maybe quality assurance or something, whereas the growth hierarchy person is like, you know, filled with a sense of responsibility to the greater whole. And, you know, there's a lot of room for conflict there. A lot.
Right. Right.
When you
right.
put the two
right.
together, you can go, oh, my gosh, you know. But then I also extrapolated it into, you know, what we see in the corporate culture, that there's also a deficiency hierarchy and there's also a growth hierarchy. And they're two different models of doing business, and people who are coming from those different models and what do they experience and what kinds of conflict do they have. And then finally, I put that grid together with the needs of a nation. In other words, what are the needs of the body politic? What makes a nation self-actualized? What, you know, makes relations between nations work? How are they negotiating? And, you know, we only have to read the news to see how really crude, you know, we are with one another at that level.
Right.
Truly, you know, if individuals behaved the way we are behaving as nations, we would be locked up for, you know, assault and domestic violence or some, you know, equivalent. I mean, bullying, you know, we do not do well there. And so I'm trying to look at what are the dynamics that, you know, if you look at nations, I mean, there's never been any nation ever, you know, where everybody in the nation's needs are met.
Right.
You know, just fundamental safety needs, economic needs, you know, food, shelter, whatever. I mean, nobody has achieved that. Why not? You know, how is it that maybe we can all embrace, since we all have these needs, you know, this as a new organizing principle for some of the decisions we make. So that's what that workshop is about. It's a real passion of mine.
Yes.
I think it's important to cut through. It's not about their positions. It's not about, you know, the specific etiology of the whatever. You know, no, come on. It's, you know, this is
right.
about we're all here. We have the same needs, and we have to learn how to negotiate them,
well,
you know, in a principled way, you know, not
yeah.
in a bullying way, but in a principled way. And so I'm trying to create a framework of understanding that's very basic, you know, but is not just basic in a stupid way. It's fundamental, like DNA.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So that's what that one's about, Many Faces of Maslow. It's on my website.
Well, it sounds like any practitioner who's in the New York area, and what is the date of the...
It's a one-day. It's on November 30th, which is Saturday after Thanksgiving, from 9 to 5. And it's going to be at 151 West 25th Street on the 12th floor in New York. And you have to pre-register on my website.
Okay. And what is your URL?
My URL is www.commonground, all lowercase, one word, commonground-adr.org.
Okay. So it is www, which people keep telling me you don't have to say that anymore, but, you know, it's habit.
It is. We just want to make sure. At least we don't say
exactly.
http://, you know, whatever.
But the URL then is commonground-adr.com.
Dot org.
Did I get that right? Oh, dot org.
Dot org.
Glad. We've got clarification on that. Okay.
Commonground-adr.org.
Okay,
yeah.
That's wonderful. And so folks can go to your website for more specific information about that particular training and
Absolutely.
To sign up, of course, which is most important. This sounds like a fascinating study. I know that it's one that I'm personally interested in.
I want
and,
you in that training. I
yes.
want to see you.
Well, it is my intention to be there. And, of course, I have to say, because folks may be listening to this show long after we have aired it, this is, of course, November 30th, 2013, in New York City.
Correct.
Great. Well, Deborah, it's been fabulous talking with you. I was looking forward to this conversation, and it certainly has delivered. And I would love for you to be able to come back sometime, and we could chat a little bit more about the kind of work you do.
I would love to. I would love to, and I look forward to meeting you in New York.
Ah, me too.
Yes, yes,
although
absolutely.
Although I think that we'd make a really interesting pair. You're nearly 6 feet tall. I barely got over 5 feet.
Mutton chap, I love it. That's really great. That's fun.
So, yes, I have to express my presence in a different way, perhaps, than you do.
Well, you've got a lot of power in your punch there. You do. I know
well, we
you
all,
do.
Well, we all do. We all have our place of grounding and centering that we contribute to the mediation process, those of us who are practitioners. Well, it's been quite a pleasure talking with you, and I wish you the very best as you move forward in your practice.
Thank you so much, and we'll talk again. Be well.
All right. You too.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, thank you for listening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to leave you with a song, as is my habit of doing. It's a piece that I've played before, but it's a favorite, by one of my favorite musicians and composers. His name is Brandon Ross. He is a master guitarist and an amazing teacher as well. I've had the opportunity to learn from him. The song is called South, and it's from his album Puppet. Have a wonderful week. Shit.